Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, David Onick. Our topic this hour is the minimum wage. Will raising the minimum wage help address increasing income equality in the Bay Area? Popular opinion seems to think so. A recent poll in the San Francisco Chronicle showed that 59% of respondents supported a minimum wage increase in San Francisco to $15 an hour from the current rate of $10.74 an hour. This would make San Francisco's the highest minimum wage in the country at about $30,000 a year. However, not all economists agree that raising the minimum wage is effective at pulling people out of poverty. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office issued a report recently reflecting both the risks and the rewards of increasing the minimum wage. Tonight on City Visions, we'll try to put the politics aside and understanding the minimum wage debate as it goes local. Does the Bay Area's unique economic climate change anything? Who will benefit most? What happens when adjacent cities have different minimum wages? Joining me in studio to discuss these issues and more are Ken Jacobs, chair of the UC Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education and the Institute for Research on Labor and Employment. Welcome, Ken.
Good evening.
Henry Kornilowitz, president of the San Francisco Council of District Merchants Associations and the South of Market Business Association. Welcome, Henry.
Good evening. Thank you.
And Samantha Adame, organizer for Young Workers United and affiliate of Progressive Workers United. Young Workers United is a multiracial and bilingual membership organization dedicated to improving the quality of jobs for young and immigrant workers. Welcome, Samantha.
Good to be here.
Later in the program, we will ask you, our listeners, to call in and join our conversation. You can email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website at kalw.org. Let's start by just getting an overview of where we are with the minimum wage. This is an incredibly hot topic right now. President Obama proposed raising the minimum wage in his State of the Union, and that is going through Congress in Washington now, a proposal to raise the federal minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. California recently raised its minimum wage for the state to $10 an hour, signed by Governor Jerry Brown. Senator Mark Leno now has a proposal to raise it further to $13 an hour over a number of years. And here in San Francisco, there are signatures being gathered as we speak to raise the minimum wage locally to $15 an hour, while other cities and states around the country are also coming forward with their own proposals. Ken, you have studied this issue for a long time. Why is it such a hot and timely issue right now?
Well, first, a lot of this reflects real economic insecurity for workers, right? Real wages for low and middle income workers have stagnated and declined while incomes at the top have skyrocketed. So if we look at what's happened going into the Great Recession, about 22% of the jobs that were lost were low-wage service sector jobs. But coming out of the recession, 44% of the jobs that have been created are those low-wage service sector jobs. So what you're really seeing is a hollowing out in the middle in this growth of low-wage jobs. This is the issue is even more significant in urban areas where we're seeing housing costs spike. So in San Francisco, between 2005 and 2013, the median rents grew at twice the rate of the minimum wage. So already in 2005, you'd need 130 hours of work at the minimum wage to pay the median rent. And now that's up to about 148 hours. So that's a significant issue. And then on the other side, you see real inaction at the federal level. If the minimum wage had kept up with inflation since 1968, the federal minimum wage, it would be $10.60 an hour today. And if it had kept up with the rate of productivity, how much an average worker is producing, it would be $22.62 an hour. Huge difference. And so what we're seeing is the gains going to more and more to people at the top and people in the middle and at the bottom really struggling. And so that's put a big impetus behind people looking at for solutions and what they can do.
Well, you raised a lot of points that we'll be circling back to. But Samantha, I want to go to you next. And in your work, how has the minimum wage become a priority issue?
I think it's definitely always been a priority. A lot of workers are struggling, you know, day to day lives. They live paycheck to paycheck. Their hours fluctuate. So I think it's raising the minimum wage would help to bring some stability in a sense, and I think really help these low wage workers out. I'd also like to clarify another point before we move forward.
Please do.
With the proposal, we're not gathering signatures yet. So we're not at that stage yet.
Oh, okay. I know there are different groups working on it. I'm not sure if your group, who else you are working with, but I know there are a number of people out there right now with proposals in San Francisco. But thank you for that clarification. Henry, let me turn next to you. Working with small businesses in the city, this is an issue that is on their mind as well.
Yes, certainly is. You know, it's very hard to get consensus because we have an industry where you have manufacturing, you've got restaurants, you've got retail, you've got all sorts of businesses out there, large and small. And for a lot of them, they feel that we're going to be priced out of the market if we go too high. A lot of people have this idea that, oh, small businesses are making a ton of money. They're out there just like, you know, getting rich out of the people who work for them, which really isn't true. Actually, a lot of small businesses are probably making not much more than the people that even work for them. By the time you figure all your overheads, all your costs, your insurance, your health care, your sick leave, all those sort of things. So when you come to all that, particularly when you come to manufacturing, SF Made, who have just been around for a short while, they're going to be hit if the cost just goes straight up to a level of the 15 that sort of people are talking about. And so there's very big concern that the small business industry doesn't want to see that happening. Also, we look at other places like New York, for example, where the minimum wage there is like $8, some $8.40 or something. I forget, don't have it right in front of me. But and New York is a much more expensive city. Now, mind you, this is for the New York State, not just because unlike San Francisco, we have a city and county. In New York, we have the city, and then you've got the state itself. So I believe this minimum wage is just for the whole state. But even so, I mean, New York is a city of, 20-odd million people or so. And so for us, from what I'm hearing from the small industry, small businesses, is that they feel they're going to be really, there could be a crunch on them, and they're going to have a tough time surviving.
Well, we will delve into some of those issues, some of the concerns of small business as we continue with our program. Ken, I want to come back to you to kind of, can you just give us the landscape with activity at the federal, state, and local level? How does it all fit together? It seems bewildering probably to some of our listeners to kind of understand how these pieces fit together and really where we are in the Bay Area right now.
Sure. So there is a bill, the Harkin-Miller bill, to raise the federal minimum wage from $7.25 to $10.10 an hour. It's headed to the Senate right now. It doesn't look likely to make it through the Senate, or if it did, to make it through the House immediately, but there is a big push on that. At the state level, the minimum wage is currently $8 an hour. It goes up to $9 an hour in July, and then in 2016, it'll go up to $10. And Senator Mark Leno from San Francisco has a bill that would bring it to $13 by 2017. But then we've got a number of proposals at the local level here. So in San Francisco, there's several discussions about raising the minimum wage over time to $15 an hour. People are collecting signatures in Oakland to do a minimum wage there of $12.25 an hour. There's a bill on the floor in Richmond, California, to raise the minimum wage. Berkeley is looking at it. San Jose did last year. Other Bay Area cities are also considering it. There's proposals in San Diego and Los Angeles. Seattle's looking at $15 an hour. So we're really seeing activity all over the country. And I think it's important to note that part of this local activity is in response to the failure at other levels to take action. But part of it is a reality that costs of living are just higher in urban areas. And What's the appropriate minimum wage in San Francisco or Oakland is higher than it is in Merced or Fresno. So it makes sense for us to have different regional wages.
By all accounts, it seems unlikely that the federal legislation will move forward in this Congress. But it does seem like congressional Democrats are going to possibly use this issue on the stump in the midterm elections. I'm wondering if you think that will trickle down to the state and local level, kind of that it's in the national discussion, even if it's not being passed at the national level, to perhaps help some of these efforts at the state and local level.
Absolutely. Minimum wage is an extremely popular issue. It's popular among Democrats, it's popular among independents, and it's popular among Republicans. And so besides being a smart thing to do, there's good reason why the Democrats are out pushing it. And there's state ballot initiatives that'll be all over the country this November as well, including places like North Dakota, I mean, Arkansas, the home of Walmart. You've got a pretty big mix of places that are state initiatives to also raise the minimum wage, and that does play in with all of the, with all of the politics. So I think with the President Obama out there in the State of the Union address, he called not only on, he said, you know, Congress to raise the minimum wage, but he said, every governor and mayor, if you take action, you'll have support. And I think that really has also helped unleash a lot of activity at the local level and at the state level.
You talked about the federal inaction, and it seems that it's not only that it hasn't been raised, but that it has not been tagged to inflation moving forward, because it just stays at the same rate unless government acts. That's very hard to do. How many of these new initiatives at the local, state, or federal level do write into the legislation that there would be cost of living increases over time automatically without having to go back to the legislator or the voters?
Of the 9 city and county minimum wages that have already been passed, 7 are indexed to inflation, I believe. That's the most common thing to do. Many of the states are indexed to inflation. California is not. So, but Oregon, Washington, Nevada, everyone, all the states surrounding us are. And in most of the bills that are being moved, that's a key element. And it's smart because then it goes up steadily, and you don't get the sort of what we have now, which is people's wages, real wages adjusted for inflation, erode, and then they get moved up quickly, which isn't great for business either. It's better to have that
right,
stable growth.
As Henry was saying, that is right. Another point, though, you talked about the rising rents in these urban areas and how many hours you would have to work to meet rent. Isn't it true that even at $15 an hour in the Bay Area, you would have to work an enormous number of hours to make a rent payment? And so how much can this realistically, even if it is passed at $15 an hour, help influence the housing crisis in the Bay Area?
It doesn't solve the housing crisis, but it does help people who are in very difficult situations right now. So people are having to make very hard decisions about covering rent, covering food, other needs. Takes off some of that pressure, but clearly to solve the housing crisis, there's lots of other steps that need to be taken. I think of this as sort of one tool in a very big toolbox.
Samantha, let me turn to you and hear more about what your organization, Young Workers United, is doing with low-wage workers.
Yeah, so we do a lot of Know Your Rights education training, and we also deal with a lot of cases that involve wage theft. So people who don't know what wage theft is when people aren't getting paid minimum wage, they're not getting paid overtime, not getting paid sick days, just a variety of wage issues that come up and workers aren't paid for it. So we help them file claims with the city or the state or deal directly with their employer and try to solve it at the local level, first with their employer, and then if we can't solve it that way, then we move on and file with the city or the state. But we also do a lot of work around immigrant rights and workers' rights.
And some of the groups that are overrepresented among low-wage workers, minimum-wage workers, are women, number one, mm-hmm. and youth, number two. Could you talk about your work with those two groups?
So we don't really work with youth as much, but we do work with a lot of people of color, a lot of immigrant workers, and a lot of women, majority, that work in restaurants. So I think it's often the individuals that are taken advantage of the most, and I think also the individuals that are struggling the most to survive in the city. And I think also I wanted to touch on something that Ken talked, or what
Please
you guys
do.
Were talking about, the housing issue. I think I agree with Ken that I don't think it's going to solve the housing issue, but I think there's also a lot of organizing going on in the city around housing rights. So I think it's great to be able to tie both of those things, right, that there is organizing being done around minimum wage, but then there also is a lot of organizing being done around housing rights and helping tenants in San Francisco.
And what about undocumented workers? To what extent do you see them being taken advantage of? And to what extent would a law like raising the minimum wage help them if maybe they're not getting paid what they're legally entitled to already?
Yeah, definitely a lot of undocumented individuals are the most taken advantage. They're usually, in some cases, aren't getting paid minimum wage or aren't getting paid overtime and are very scared to come forward. And so I think it's, you know, about not only raising the minimum wage, but also doing the educational piece and the outreach and making sure that individuals know, you know, whenever the minimum wage does go up, we do a lot of education around it and let people know that, you know, they should check their paychecks and make sure that they are getting paid the correct legal minimum wage, and to educate them on what the steps they could take are if they, you know, if they aren't getting paid minimum wage. But it's definitely a lot of cases do come forward with undocumented individuals.
Henry, let's circle back and talk about small business owners in the city. You had mentioned some of their concerns. Is there a general concern, would you say, about raising the minimum wage? Or is it the, as Ken was talking about, kind of going from one plateau and then going quickly up to another plateau? Is it the extent of the potential raise in the middle minimum wage that concerns people? Or do people want to hold the line completely in general?
Boy, difficult question. There are some who would like to hold it as it is, because remember that in San Francisco, our minimum wage keeps going up each year. I think it's tied to the CPI, unlike rents. Rents are only increased by 60% of the CPI. And when we talk about housing, a lot of people who in San Francisco actually have lived here for a long time and they're under rent control. So I would say that. But a lot of them do agree that, you know, they don't mind it going up, but not so drastically in such a short period of time. So if they have the 5 years or whatever to take it up to a certain level, they could probably live with it. But remember, it's the competition, too. I mean, if you're going to make a bag in San Francisco for a certain amount of dollars, and then it gets to a point where your profit margin is so low, you know, you're going to go to Taiwan and open up a factory over there, and people are going to lose their jobs. I do want to also want to say about the these are entry level jobs. The minimum wage for entry level. Most people you find in the small business community get paid more than a minimum wage. A lot of people that I've spoken to, a lot of them make, you know, 14, 15, 16, even more than that. So. It's just the entry level. And what happens with that, too, is with the entry level, if that goes up to a certain level, and it's high, let's say, then in San Leandro or in Hayward, you're going to have people coming over here. And if the qualifications are slightly better than someone who's over here, people will be hiring someone to come from who's coming from San Leandro or Hayward to get a job. And whereas the folks over here who don't have those qualifications will not be getting that job.
Let me two of the concerns that are raised from a small business perspective is one that either small businesses will have to, as you said, decrease employment, whether send jobs overseas or just hire less people, or increase prices, which then poor consumers will pay the price for that. Are people raising both of those concerns with you? And I know some of Ken's research has refuted some of those points, so we can go to Ken afterward. But are those concerns in people's minds?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is pretty well common with a lot of them. So, look, you know what? If it goes up so much, I'm going to increase my prices. And so what we're looking at inflation at the end of the day. If you're going to start doing that, you know, so if the store owners, whatever they're selling, they increase their prices, so then everything else goes in likewise. It all starts going up. So that definitely is, yes. Otherwise, how are you going to make it? But to what level can you keep going up and up? You know, if you're a bookstore owner, you know, you can't. Amazon's come along and going to put you out of business.
Ken, could you jump in here?
Sure. First, I think it's important to point out that most of the jobs, the vast majority of the jobs we're talking about that are low-wage jobs in San Francisco are location-specific service sector jobs. Manufacturing is a very small sector of our employment in San Francisco, and the median wage in manufacturing in San Francisco is $60,000 a year. Where most of these jobs are is the restaurant sector, retail, janitors, security guards, home care workers. They're low-wage, place-specific service sector jobs. And so there's a lot of research on what happens when minimum wages are increased. And one thing, looking at the minimum wages that have been increased at the levels we've seen in the United States and in San Francisco to date, you haven't seen those kinds of declines in employment. So there's some of my colleagues looked at over a 16-year period, every time there's been a different minimum wage on either side of a state border because the states had different minimum wages. What were the impact on restaurant jobs on either on those two counties that are right next to each other over the border? And what they found is you can't find any statistically significant impact on employment, on restaurant employment, on teen employment. So how are those costs absorbed? What you do see is a decline in turnover. So people stay on the job longer when wages are higher. And that saves employers money. You see improvements in customer service, declines in absenteeism, declines in grievances, less equipment damage, better equipment maintenance. All of those things also save employers money. So about a 20%, a little more of the cost is absorbed that way. And most of the rest does come through in slightly higher prices. But it's important to put this in context. When thinking about the pass-through to price, you have to look at both usually a smaller share of the workers are earning at or near the minimum wage, and labor is only a part of overall costs. So a 25% increase in the minimum wage in San Francisco in 2004 led to a 2.8% increase in restaurant prices above what you saw in the rest of the Bay Area. Retail impacts are much smaller because wages, labor is a smaller part of their total cost. And outside restaurant and retail, the impacts are really negligible. So you don't see any kind of broad general inflation as a result of minimum wage increase. And all of this is very well researched and very well documented.
Okay, you are listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing the minimum wage with our guests, Ken Jacobs, chair of the UC Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education and the Institute for Research on Labor and Employment, Henry Kornilowitz, president of the San Francisco Council of District Merchants Associations and the South of Market Business Association, and Samantha Adame, organizer for Young Workers United and affiliate of Progressive Workers United. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Are you a minimum wage worker? Do you employ minimum wage workers? We want to hear from you. The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website at kalw.org. The research that you were talking about, is it clear cut, or are there research? Are there economists fighting about this back and forth?
Sure, you get a group of economists; they'll always fight about something. But I think it's important we look at what's happened in understanding of minimum wage over the years, because it's always been known by economists that there are these different kinds of impacts of raising the minimum wage. You raise the cost of labor so you could reduce the demand, but on the other hand, you increase the supply of labor because more people can work at those wages. And so it's long been known that it's really an empirical question. You're not going to answer it by theory alone. And I think it's important to remember, people aren't widgets. If you raise the price of a screwdriver, that screwdriver isn't going to take screws out any better. If you raise and pay a worker more, their behavior changes. That's how you get the reduced turnover, the improvements in other places. So in the mid-1990s, UC Berkeley economists David Card and Alan Krueger out of Princeton did this study looking at the New Jersey-Pennsylvania border with fast food restaurants on either side and found that restaurant employment growth actually was slightly faster on the New Jersey side with the higher minimum wage in terms of the fast food restaurants. And that sparked this whole debate within economics. And there was a recent survey done by the University of Chicago of economists. And there was a very small fraction of the economists surveyed who thought that the harm caused by the minimum wage outweighed the good. That is, more and more the view is the opposite, that while there may be differences in, you know, if you look across the research, the general view is impact on employment is from nothing to vanishingly small. And the general view more and more is that the good far outweighs the harm. Now, all of that research has been done on minimum wage increases that are to the size we've seen today. And as we go way above those levels, then more questions are raised and that we have less empirical research to draw on.
Okay, let's open up the phones here. We have a call from Jason in San Francisco. Jason, welcome to City Visions.
Hi, thank you very much. great conversation you guys are having.
Thanks for calling in. What is your question for our guests?
So I had a question for the gentleman that mentioned, and I thought I heard it right. I'm driving. I just pulled over now. That the increase
safety
in
first.
Wage, increases restaurant prices by 2% and change, and that doesn't cause. That's not an inflation rise. And if most people in San Francisco eat out at least a couple times a week, how is that not an increase in inflation?
So I'd say that is an increase in costs, but it's a pretty small increase in costs compared to what it means for the wages going into those workers' pockets. And then remember, those workers who now have more money in their pockets are also spending that money in the local economy. And low-wage workers spend more of their money, and they spend more of it locally than do higher-income workers. One way to really think about this is some of the UC Berkeley economists has argued that for every new tech job you create, there's about four or five other jobs created, of which three of those are low-wage service sector jobs. And what the minimum wage does is shares that prosperity. So sure, some people are paying a little bit more and emphasize that it's this very small amounts more when they go out to eat. And that means workers have significant increases in their earnings and are better able to survive and support their families.
Thank you for that question, Jason. And Henry, let me ask you whether small business owners see that potential benefit of increasing the minimum wage, that low-income workers would have more expendable income, which, as Ken just said, they tend to spend in the local mom-and-pop stores near their homes.
Well, now you're paying a minimum wage earner more money. So that what your profit that you're getting, you're paying out to have these people working for you. So at the end of the day, I don't think you really come out, you know, it doesn't really come out that way. I don't believe so. I think you're going to find if the costs go up, they go up because of the people that you have to hire to pay them more money. And so when you look at that way, the amount of money that you're getting, but by the time you pay off, it's a wash, if not even a loss.
Okay. Samantha, I'd like to delve in with you a little bit more about what are the types of positions that folks you're working with have who are earning the minimum wage here in San Francisco. So people can picture what are the jobs now that are minimum wage jobs in the city.
Yeah, so a lot of the individuals that we work with are back of the house in restaurants. So a lot of dishwashers, line prep, and, you know, some of those have moved on to other positions, but a lot of them are definitely not the front of the house, like, you know, not the servers or the hostess, just the dishwashers and bussers, barbacks. A lot of retail individuals, so sales associates that work in big chain stores. So those are the people that we see that come into our office.
And how many of them are the primary breadwinner in a family, say a single mom versus, say, a teen or young adult living with their parents but earning the minimum wage themselves? Not statistics, but just anecdotally from the folks you work with.
I mean, the majority of them are the breadwinners in their family and are, you know, providing for not only their family, but some of their extended families as well. And so it's definitely, you know, yeah, they're the breadwinners. That's their livelihood. They're trying to survive off that money.
An interesting fact I learned is that there are some folks in San Francisco who legally are being paid less than the minimum wage because they, for example, there are certain school district employees, because they work for the school district, are paid a lower minimum wage than folks in San Francisco. And I know a school board member, Matt Haney, is trying to change that now. I don't think most of our listeners were probably aware of that. Can I see you shaking your head? Can you explain how that works how many categories of workers are there like this?
San Francisco has jurisdiction over the geography of San Francisco and businesses that are on land outside owned by San Francisco, like the airport or Hetch Hetchy. It does not have jurisdiction over state or federal workers or other things like the school board, which is an independent entity, that are located within San Francisco. So San Francisco cannot tell the federal government you have to pay federal workers more, or the state government you have to pay state workers more. Those workers are all decided by the respective laws that govern them.
This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. Tonight we're discussing the minimum wage with our guests, Ken Jacobs, chair of the UC Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education and the Institute for Research on Labor and Employment, Henry Kornilowitz, president of the San Francisco Council of District Merchants Associations and the South of Market Business Association, and Samantha Adame, organizer for Young Workers United. Again, we invite you to call in with your questions or comments. The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website, kalw.org. Let's go to an email next. We have an email from Kate who asks, is there a threshold in increasing the minimum wage? How is it determined? Ken, why don't you give that a shot? Well, I know it's different, of course, whether you're talking federal, state, local, but...
Well, it's determined politically in the sense of each local government at that level sets the wage based on a variety of factors, a combination of looking at what's the cost of living, what do people need in order to get by, and what do they think that businesses can bear, what can the economy bear. And if you look across the United States and around the world, you see wide variations. In Australia, it's $16, the equivalent of $16 an hour. In parts of the United States, it's $7.25. In Switzerland right now, there's a debate around about $20 an hour. So you see this some level of variation. But if we look at what's happened in the United States, again, like of the nine cities and counties that have passed local minimum wage laws, the average increase has been 40%, but most of them have done it in steps, and the average step increase has been about 17%. So in order to avoid those kind of big cliffs, we've seen them phased in over 2 years or 3 years in order to get up there and then indexed from there. And that's what we've seen with a number of the state increases as well.
Could I just chime in for a second?
Please do. Though
I forgot to say earlier about the increases in the wages and increase of cost. But what happens there also, most of your small businesses rent their places. Their rent doesn't go down. Even the rent goes up too. So it even gets tougher for them. So I just wanted to bring that across. I forgot to mention earlier.
Well, we certainly do hear a lot of stories in the city about small businesses or nonprofits that are having rents raised and the struggles that they face and that this could potentially be another challenge for them. So somehow we need to all come together and come up with solutions to this where everybody is working together and realizing also, well, the minimum wage may help. As Ken said, it's not going to be a panacea that's going to solve all of the Bay Area's problems. And Samantha, I'm wondering if you can talk about how you advocate for the minimum wage along with other things that you're advocating for to increase the well-being of the folks you're working with. What are some of the other main issues that you help people with?
It's mostly about wage theft, and I think also just talking about immigrant rights and that conversation. That's a lot different than the wage conversation.
Sure.
But I think we definitely just go out and talk to workers and see what the issues that they're facing are.
Where do you find them? How do you go out and talk to workers? How do they trust you to talk to you?
We literally go out to the restaurants and where they're working at and just also try to connect and network with the people that we already work with and have them bring people in. And I think it's surprising how open people become. I think to individuals, it's always surprising how trusting people are. And I think as long as you come off in a genuine way, people are going to, you know, trust you and know that you're not, you know, trying to get all this other information from them, that you genuinely want to know what's wrong and what's going on.
We have an email question from Wendy, Samantha, that I think you could help with, too, which is, do minimum wage workers live in San Francisco? If not, where are they coming from? Because I would imagine a lot of these workers, to our earlier points, can't afford to live in the city anymore.
So the people that we interact do live in the city. I think there are, at least the majority of the restaurant workers do live. There are some of the sales associates or individuals that are younger that work in retail that do commute from the East Bay. But the majority of those are students that are already commuting for school. So while they're commuting for school, they're also going to work after school. But I'd say that the majority of them do live in San Francisco.
Ted Egan, the city economist, estimates that about 70% of low-wage workers people in low-wage jobs in San Francisco live in San Francisco, and in occupations like in-home supportive service workers, home care workers, it's even much higher than that.
And to what extent do you think workers are aware of different minimum wages in different counties as they look at jobs? And related to that is, I know Mayor Tom Bates in Berkeley is proposing kind of an East Bay minimum wage that maybe would eventually become a Bay Area minimum wage. So I'm wondering, both from a worker's perspective and from a policymaker's perspective, what having all these cities next to each other, how that plays out. Ken, you want to take the first shot at that?
I think it's a great question. In thinking about how far will people go to commute for a job, you have to think about both if they're going to live there, what's the difference in rental cost, or what's the difference in transportation costs. So people will commute for a higher wage, but there are some limits on that. When you look at something like the East Bay, there's a real logic to having a common wage across the various East Bay cities. If it's a small amount difference in each city, it's not going to have that much of an impact, although maybe a little more confusing for employers if they happen to have workers in multiple cities. But overall, if wages in San Francisco are much higher than the others, you might see more workers coming in. But if the East Bay cities also raise their minimum wage, as they're talking about, then that'll tend to level out a bit more.
To what extent do you think that would affect the workers you work with?
I think it wouldn't really change things. I think there are a lot of people there are some people that commute, but it's also a matter of if the commute's worth coming over here, because a lot of times it's part-time workers that don't see it being worth it, so they just get a job in Oakland or in the East Bay where they may be living. I think majority of them would still be people living in San Francisco, not necessarily commuters, because I think the cost of commuting is also an issue.
From a small business perspective, are most of the workers people who live in the neighborhood close to where the businesses are located?
Pretty well. Depends which industry you're looking at. I would say quite a few. But you have to remember that the rents are way, way lower in Haywood and San Leandro and places like that. So I know of people who work in the construction industry, for example, and they live across the bay and they come over. Of course, they get more than the minimum wage, however. But it's the manufacturing industry, which is just starting to pick up, SF made. And those are the ones that I think are really going to be hit more by it than anybody else, because with as long as across the bay everybody's getting the same wage, that's the minimum wage, then it's equal playing field. But when you come to manufacturing, now we have a competition not just from here but from overseas.
And please go ahead.
Can you give me an example of manufacturing, because I'm trying to paint a picture in my head?
People who make bags, make cups, plates, bind books. It's amazing how many there are right now with what was started about maybe 3 or 4 or 5 years ago. And it's really just starting to boom. It's really starting to pick up. But this is from the people I've heard who are in that industry are saying that.
And for certain types of businesses, you have to be in the location you're at. But for the types of businesses you're describing, it seems like they could theoretically say, San Francisco's minimum wage is $15. I move across the bay and I'm going to have a minimum wage of $10. It's going to make sense for me. I'll have a lower rent, a lower minimum wage. I'm going to move. To what extent do you think if the minimum wage was raised, that might be something some business owners would think about?
Well, I think it's pretty true. I think it's really serious. I know of companies who have moved their warehouses over to across the bay because the rents for warehouses are so high over here. So for these in the manufacturing industry, if it does go up to the 15, I'm pretty certain a lot of them are going to just have to move. It's not going to make sense for them financially to be able to compete.
Just to get on that, manufacturing is very, very small in San Francisco, and the median wage in manufacturing is well over the wage that we're talking about. The thing that's going to drive that more than anything is rents. and the other operation cost much, much more so than wages.
I want to come back and talk about restaurant workers, who are some of the main folks that we are talking about here. But first, let's take our final station break. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing the minimum wage with our guests, Ken Jacobs, chair of the UC Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education, and the Institute for Research on Labor and Employment, Henry Kornilowitz, president of the San Francisco Council of District Merchants Associations and the South of Market Business Association, and Samantha Adame, organizer for Young Workers United. You can call in and join our conversation at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website, which is kalw.org. Circling back to restaurant workers, which is one of the main groups we're talking about, I know a very sticky issue in this minimum wage debate has been how tips are calculated. And I'm wondering, I'd like each of you to weigh in on this, because I know this has been a real sticking point for folks trying to come up with some compromises on this issue. Ken, you want to lead us off? Samantha.
I think I definitely don't believe in tip credit. I think, you know, individuals like to say that people get really high tips. But, I mean, that varies from restaurant to restaurant. There's some individuals that only get, you know, $20 in tips a day, if that. So I think for individuals, I would say, you know, we should do tip credit for tipped workers is something that I don't agree with, and I don't see it working out for the workers.
Henry?
Well, this is an issue with people that I know in the restaurant industry about the tip credits. Put it as a state law, though, they can't do it. That's the only problem with that. But and now I want to tell you, I'm not siding with anybody over here, okay? I'm just trying to tell you what I'm hearing, right? But, yeah, no, that's the way that they feel about this should be.
Yeah, that's right. California does not allow tip credit. Under California law, the tips a worker earns are their property and not the property of the employer. Nationally, in a good number of states, they do have tip credit. And what that means is, while the general minimum wage is $7.25 an hour, the tipped worker wage is only $2.13 an hour. And partly as a result, tipped workers nationally are twice as likely to live in poverty as workers overall. And people have this image of the, as Samantha was saying, of sort of the tipped worker, you know, works in the fanciest restaurant and brings home significant amounts of money. And then you look on the other side and think about the person working the night shift in the diner, bringing in very, very little money. And so you do have this wide variation. And so because of the overall law, and because of that variation, I think that's something we won't see in San Francisco. None of the cities and counties that are in states that don't allow for tip credit or don't have tip credit have put it into their laws.
You know, you raise an interesting point that I'd been wanting to come back to, which is that when we talk about restaurant workers and restaurants, there's such a huge range of restaurants in this city and workers in those restaurants. And so that really cuts both ways. Both, you know, a worker at a local fast food place is in a very different position than a worker at a very high-end restaurant. At the same time, if a high-end restaurant has to raise their prices, oh, well, you know, the 1% can pay for that, but at some of the more affordable places, then that really could affect these low-wage workers if prices are increased potentially because of the minimum wage. So I'm wondering if with the folks you work with, do they work at all kinds of places, and what kinds of differences do you see depending on the level of restaurant that they're working at?
Yeah, I mean, they work at all types of places, but it's usually the individuals are working more than one job, so mm-hmm. It's not like they're working at one place. Can you repeat the question again?
Well, I'm just, again, that instead of saying that this is a homogeneous group, that these are just restaurant workers, there are many different kinds of restaurant workers who are getting big differences in tips and wages, I would imagine.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure how much they're getting in tips, but I think, it definitely varies from wages or hourly wages. There's definitely some workers that do get paid more than minimum wage, and there's definitely some workers that are, you know, making minimum wage.
And I think it's important to note that a lot of the push for doing these citywide minimum wage laws really came out of the fast food worker strikes that we saw around the country. And so all these fast food workers who were organizing and that their demands were $15 an hour plus a union. And that sort of that's where that 15 comes from. That really sort of sparked that off. And we did some research on fast food workers, and over half of fast food workers nationally, their family members are on one or more public assistance programs. And that was true even for people who are working full time. I mean, right. Wages are very low. And when you talk about the demographics in the industry, turns out there are more fast food workers who are parents who have a child that they're taking care of than are teenagers 18 and under living at home with their parents. I mean,
back to Samantha's right. point from earlier. Yes.
Yeah, the demographics of who are low-wage workers has really shifted in the United States since the 70s. And we're talking 80% have a high school education or more, 30% have some college or more. It's a very different demographic than people have of the, sort of their image of who fast food workers are or who low-wage workers are. And I think it's been some of the real push and impetus behind what we're seeing.
But then on the other hand, too, if you start going to 15, people who are making 15 are going to say, oh, and 20, and the ones who have got 20 are oh, and 25.
Well, yes, that latter. So there are two different points here. Hold that thought, because I want to follow up on something with Ken that you mentioned, which is the percentage of folks who are getting government benefits while working in a fast food restaurant, say. So there's certainly an argument that if you raise the minimum wage, it would save the government money because people would be less reliant on government programs to make ends meet if they were getting more income. Does the data back that up at all?
It does. I mean, if you look at things like food stamps, we have large right. numbers of people who work in the restaurant industry or work in the food retail industry who have to rely on food stamps in order to meet their basic budgets. And we looked overall, something recently we did with NPR, in fact, I said if Walmart was to raise their wages up to $13.62 an hour, enough so a single mother with a child didn't have to rely on food stamps, what would it do to Walmart prices? And it ended up adding a penny. You know, we calculated it would add a penny to the box of a macaroni and cheese, So we're talking the overall impact on prices would be very, very small, but the impact on the workers are quite large. And it does mean that people could earn enough to survive and support their families and would need less government assistance.
Samantha, do you find that most of the people you work with are on government assistance in addition to the minimum wage jobs that they have?
Some of them are. I mean, it varies from person to person. I don't think too many of the people that we're working with are. But, I mean, they definitely do rely on a lot of the services that the city offers.
Henry, I want to come back to your point, which is that there is an argument by some small businesses said, okay, if I have my supervisors at $15 an hour now, if I make the minimum wage $15 an hour, then I can't have my supervisors making the same amount as my line staff. So that means that I also have to raise for my supervisor. Now, some may say that's a good thing because we want the supervisors to be making more as well. But some small business owners are saying you need to calculate that into the cost and that will have negative repercussions for my business. How much are you hearing that from the folks you're working with?
Well, that is one of the big things. That's why that $15 amount is so that they're really not happy with. They really feel that it's going to spiral up from the 15 to the 20 to the 25. I mean, I know someone who's close to me, and she's getting $16 something right now. And she says, well, you know what? If the minimum wage goes up to 15, I'm going to want 20. And so that's in a small business community, that's what the feeling is out there. If we start raising, it's going to start going all the way through. And at the end of the day, it's going to be the small business is going to be making less profit. And we don't know where that's going to go, but they're not happy with that.
Is that, looking at the research, is that something that you're concerned about, Ken?
So you do see that wage push. It's absolutely true. If you raise the minimum wage to $10 an hour or $15, you see people right above that earn more as well. But it doesn't tend to go that far. We would expect at a $15 an hour minimum wage, where you really see the impact is between about $15 and $17.50. And they tend to get smaller increases. So what happens is you end up with some level of wage compression. That is, the difference between what people earn gets smaller, but people up to a degree above the minimum wage do tend to earn more as well.
Yeah, but, you know, $2 an hour, that's $16 a day. And how much is that a week? How much is that a year? When you've got a bunch of employees, it makes a difference.
Ken, are there places around the world or in other parts of the country that we can look to that have raised the minimum wage, that have economies that are absolutely moving forward, that could be models as we look at this?
Ken and I were speaking about this before I came into this conversation. I'm from Australia, and the minimum wage there is much higher than what it is over here. There's no doubt, you know, also going out to eat is much, much higher than it is. But I must say, going back over there, the unemployment rate is lower than it is here, I believe, at this moment. The middle class, there's a much larger middle class than there is over here. You don't see as much poverty as you have here. But I don't know if you really want to tie it in totally to the minimum wage. There's a whole bunch of other factors that play into it. The wealth of the country itself in what the country has to export. So with that being said, it's not just totally minimum wage. So don't think that it's just a $16 an hour is going to solve all our problems.
Ken?
I was going to say, in Europe, you do have some places that have higher. I mean, Australia is the example that's commonly brought out. Within the United States, San Francisco right now at 1074 is the highest, although there's been some others past that will exceed that.
And we've had ours higher than everybody else's for some time now, and our economy seems to be doing pretty well.
That's right. We did in our book that recently came out, When Mandates Work, Raising Labor Standards at the Local Level, to get in a plug here. We looked at what's happened in San Francisco since the minimum wage law and the paid sick leave law and San Francisco's health care law went into effect, among other labor standards. And what we found is wages really did go up. So you see real wages, inflation-adjusted wages, go up in San Francisco and then maintain their value for workers at the bottom because it's indexed to inflation, while real wages declined in the rest of the Bay Area or stagnated and declined during the recession. But when you look at employment, restaurant growth in San Francisco was faster than the rest of the Bay Area during this period, about 17% over the period compared to 14% in the rest of the Bay Area. So you really can't find any negative impact on employment in San Francisco from the labor standards policies that have been put into effect to date.
And other than Australia, are there other places that we could look to in particular, or do you think there are just a bunch around the world and in other parts of the country that really feel like might be doing it right?
Well, so the big difference is in Europe, historically, you've had industry-wide wage setting. So you tend to have much higher union density, a larger share of the workers are in unions. In the Scandinavian countries, a very high share of the workers are in unions. And the unions and management get together and they set wages that go across an entire industry. So with that industrial wage setting, you have much higher wages than you do in the United States. As in a number of European countries, as those systems have started to erode, they're now putting minimum wage laws into effect. So Germany just enacted a minimum wage law. So we're in terms of looking at that, but in those countries that have those higher wages, again, which they've done through higher levels of unionization and more industrial wage setting, many of those countries are doing in terms of how the workers are doing, is really quite well. Germany's maintained manufacturing much better than in the United States in a country with higher wages. So there's a lot of other things that go into it beyond simply the wage level.
And of course, but you're looking at the country, the national level, not when you have as local places setting their own wage levels, wages.
You know, in Japan, they've always had a higher minimum wage in Tokyo and other major cities than they do in the rest of the country. That, I mean, sort of the higher municipal wages has been a part of their system for a long time.
We all agree that increasing the minimum wage itself would not solve the problems of inequality. While it might help with the problem, it wouldn't solve it entirely. What are some of the other things that you recommend that would go hand in hand with a minimum wage increase to generally deal with what we all see, what the studies are showing is a rapid increase in inequality in San Francisco and the Bay Area?
Well, I mean, I think first when we think about increasing inequality, you have to think of it both at the top and at the bottom, right? There are two issues going on. One is more and more of wealth is concentrated in the top 1% and the top 10th of 1%. And then what's happening in the middle class and at the bottom, where the wages for the bottom two-thirds have stagnated or declined over the last decade or more. And things like minimum wage or good policies to bring wages up at the bottom, I mean, reforming labor law nationally would have a very large impact there as well. One of the issues that we've seen in terms of why wages have gone down in the U.S. is the decline in share of workers who are in unions. In terms of addressing many of those issues at the top, they really are federal-level issues, tax issues in terms of estate taxes, in terms of top income tax brackets. There's a question of what's the policy around full employment and in terms of both fiscal and monetary policy. And we've had policies that are much geared towards making sure interest rates don't go up, then looking at jobs and employment. And so there's a lot that really needs to be done at the federal level. At the local level, housing policy matters a lot, social service policy matters a lot, and wages and labor standards are very important.
We just have a few minutes left. I'm wondering if each of you could just leave us with a few thoughts about what to look out for in this discussion going forward. From a small business owner's perspective, what do you see in the year ahead?
Well, I think we would like to see something come across that's fair to the small business community, and not to make that raise all in one time, break it up over a period of years. And that's what we're sort of looking for. We've got feelers out. We're trying to ask what everybody's thinking about it. But that's what we just don't want to suddenly go up to $12 come January 1st of 2015.
Samantha, what do you see in the year ahead?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it's a lot of conversation, and I think everyone's open to talking and discussing, you know, between organizations and small businesses and, you know, even the mayor. So I think it's about conversation and how do we move forward as a united front.
And I think we're going to see these conversations throughout the Bay Area. We are seeing them. In some cases, we'll see ballot initiatives like we're seeing in Oakland. And I think in San Francisco, the other thing we have to look at is what else can we do for small businesses? As we're trying to raise wages and say and make sure there's some level of shared prosperity, what can we do to help small businesses stay afloat, given what's happening with rents and other costs here? So I think that's a conversation the city needs to have.
Terrific. That's City Visions for this evening. My guests were Ken Jacobs, chair of the UC Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education and the Institute for Research on Labor and Employment, Henry Kornilowitz, president of the San Francisco Council of District Merchants Associations and the South of Market Business Association, and Samantha Adame, organizer for Young Workers United and affiliate of Progressive Workers United. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was Eric Wayne. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. Join my co-host, Joseph Pache, next Monday as we discuss student data and privacy in schools. This is David Onick. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.